Okay, perfect. So thanks for inviting me to be here today. I'm glad to visit Waterloo for the first time. So today I'm gonna, on this talk, I'm gonna present a little bit my research. As it was mentioned, I'm just doing instrumentation, science, a mix of the two supporting telescopes. That's my background, and it all started in Quebec when I was a student. So I worked at University of Laval for my master and my PhD, and we were developing a prototype there for the Bomagantic Observatory. And so I spent a lot of time at the telescope, hands-on in a prototype, trying to make it work. And once it was finally working, I studied galaxies and star formation in galaxies with the prototype. Turned out to be working. It gave us enough information to get funding to build a better new one, another instrument that I helped develop during my PhD. And that's a picture of that instrument here on the telescope. That's the PI, Laurent Drissen, and that's my supervisor back then, Carmel Robert. So I developed a lot of expertise with telescopes back in those days. And when we finally got to build that second instrument, it was going to be for a larger telescope, a more international telescope, the Canada-France-Hawaii telescope. And that's a picture of the first light of the instrument after it was built. I'm right here with my computer analyzing data. There was a storm coming in. We were afraid that we would get zero time on the sky, but fortunately, the storm went sideways and we got 7 perfect nights of clear weather, and we could observe a nice object like this planetary nebula and this tiny little galaxy. That's the one I was interested in. And that's actually a color image of the planetary nebula that we made after. And then I was analyzing the galaxy in the background and get some information about this velocity curve and also the abundances and the gas of the star-forming regions in that galaxy that are highlighted here in that image and here. So right after that, I was hired to work at the Canada-France-Hawaii Telescope. I worked there for 6 years. If you don't know the Big Island of Hawaii, it's an exquisite site for astronomy and for many things, including volcanoes. and that's another image of the latest one in December when the Mauna Loa entered in eruption. The telescope are not on that mountain, but they are on the mountain that is located just to the left of that. And here it is on a good day. So the Mauna Kea is a special site. It is also a sacred site for the native Hawaiians, so there's a mix in between culture and science that happened at the summit. The science reserve is very close to the real summit of the mountain. There are ceremonies happening both at the summit and below. And within the years, we've heard a lot about it. I don't know if you have in the news, for protests that happened against the building of another telescope, yet another telescope in the Science Reserve, called the 30-meter telescope. This is still ongoing. The telescope construction is on break. But what is also nice is within those years, protests have led to changes in the way the mountain and the Science Reserve has been kind of managed. And Native Hawaiians are part of the board now that manages the mountain, which is great. Wanted to mention that. And now we teleport ourselves on the summit. This is the Canada-France-Hawaii Telescope, the inside. And I'm going to talk a little bit about star formation. So now that we've seen the facility, I'm going to show you a little bit of what do I study. And then we're going to see the instrument, or why do I use this specific instrument to study this. If you are visual like me, this is a nice simulation of star formation made by Matthew Bate at Exeter University. I like it because it's about 100 light year across cloud that evolves. But you just give it a little push, you know, a little perturbation to generate turbulence. And then within the cloud, some denser filaments form and then reach a point where it collapses into several stars, several compact objects that become stars. A cloud like this can form tens, 100, 1,000, 10,000 stars. They're all sisters made out of the same material, the same gas, the same abundance in the gas as well. And then you end up with a cluster of stars. And they're all kind of sisters into this. Sometimes it's a little bit more chaotic. You form a cloud that have like multiple clumps. And in nature, we observe both as well. So this is two different star formation region with young stellar cluster with a mostly blue young massive star at the center. There's a lot of low mass stars that are more red, but you don't see them as much because they're less bright. And this one here contains some of the most massive stars that we know in the local universe that are about 150 times the mass of the sun. I'm mentioning all of these masses because what is also important when you study star-forming regions is what we call the initial mass function, the stellar initial mass function. It's like a constant thing in the universe. When you look at all the stars that are formed in a cluster and you just do a count of how many they are and which mass they are, there seem to be a constant function that say there's going to be that many massive star for that many lower mass star. And it's a slope. And it's a constant function, this initial mass function. You only get a few massive ones for so many smaller. And those massive ones are really important because they are the ones responsible for fabricating very specific elements out of the periodic table. I like this wonderful periodic table that shows the origin of elements in their universe. And I want you to focus on the green elements that are mostly produced by explosion of massive stars. And here they are. And you probably know how important those elements are in the universe. So studying star formation, and especially the impact of massive stars in their surrounding, is extremely important to understand the chemistry of our universe. Then there's the time scale. So once a massive star is born, it produces so much high energy photons, we call them ionizing photons. They have enough energy to ionize hydrogen, 13.6 electron volt or above. And they generate a plasma bubble around the stars that are visible at really large distances. So it's hot gas, ionized gas, that lost some electrons. And it emits just like lasers emit colors at very specific wavelength, and we can identify them at large distances and also study chemistry. That's a B star, like about 10 times the mass of the sun. This is a larger one, larger bubble, bigger star, more photons. And we can compare those simulation with observation. It's something that we do a lot. Those hydrodynamic simulation can also be coupled with photoionization codes that simulate the condition in the gas directly. So you can tell basically which elements are there, what is the balance between the different ions and everything. So the ingredients you use to gather all of this nice physics is, of course, the young stellar cluster, the stars that are there, their mass, especially the massive ones. So those is a quantity you need to measure. Then you can infer a quantity of ionizing photon they emit using models of star stellar energy distribution spectrum. Then you have the gas around it. What's its density? What are the abundances of the elements in the gas? And also another element that is important is the population of those free electrons that got kicked out by those ionizing photons. So they are there swimming around and in this plasma, and there's continuous collision between the electrons and the gas. Those collisions are low energy, about electron volt, and they disturb the layers of electrons around the atoms and push them in unstable states. So they come back down after the collision. But this mechanism of pumping continuously the electron to a higher level and then bringing them back down produce very specific colors that we observe as emission line in the spectra. So that's a mechanism for observing them. And then, of course, those electrons eventually cool down by collision, many collisions, and then they can recombine. And since hydrogen is the most abundant element in space by far, what we observe in the spectra is mostly recombination line from hydrogen just because of its abundances. And you could technically observe the recombination line with metals, but they are factor of 1,000 to more, like a million times weaker, so they are much harder to see in a spectrum. This process is fairly quick, although recent papers are suggesting that to create this plasma bubble once the star is born could take, in this case it was about 300,000 years, but it could take millions of years actually for the bubble to exit the dense medium and actually be visible outside and be less embedded in very dense molecular cloud where the stars are forming. So that's one very important part. And so continue on from the stars, emission line from the gas. And that's the ingredients we have in the spectrum to study a region like this. So that's a star-forming region in a galaxy. We tend to be red because of the hydrogen emission line. Again, they kind of lit up and die as the massive stars explode within a couple of million years. So since a galaxy, like the Milky Way, rotates on itself every 250 million years, those little plasma bubbles kind of pops out when a massive star is born, and then it lives a few million years and die. And that's a very short period of time for us to observe it. And then there's a scale. So I don't know if you're familiar with the Orion Nebulae. It's one of the most like ever seen astronomy picture. it's very close from us in the Milky Way. Everybody might have seen it at some point. It's actually a very compact star-forming region. It's only four parsecs across. If we take another galaxy farther away, this is a small galaxy farther from the Milky Way of about 500,000 parsecs. In this galaxy, we have star-forming regions that are 25 times larger than Orion, just like right here. And that's a big one. You have smaller ones, all sorts of things, all the way up to the scale of Orion. And try to remember this beautiful spherical region that is like ideal for just the concept of what is a star-forming region. They're not as spherical, like you can see it here, but it is like a perfect case. If we go at larger distances even more, these galaxies here are much farther away, and then you can start to see complexes. They're also bigger galaxies. They contain more gas. They form more stars. This is 250 times the size of Orion. Our little perfect region would be about this size here. In this galaxy, we have clumps that are really large here. And I'm going to use this one. This is the first galaxy we observed with CITEL during the science verification of the instrument. And I developed a code that basically identified emission line regions, try to separate their zone of influence, where the stars are and where the gas is ionized around them. And if we zoom in into a very tiny little corner there, now these few pixels are about the size of 100 parsecs, our big regions that we just saw, because we're much farther away. And so that region is very small on the image, and Orion would be even smaller, up to a point where actually Orion would not be detected on a galaxy that far away. So we have a limit onto what we can detect. Also, regions are swimming in a lot of things in galaxy, including stellar population, so a lot of stars in galaxy, especially in the center, some dust that absorbs some of the light, and also what we call diffuse ionized gas. And I hope you can see well those kind of diffuse filaments in this galaxy here. Those are also photoionized or excited by shocks in the interstellar medium. And so they also emit light. And depending on the resolution of your images, you might notice that it is diffuse gas because you see it. But if you look at a galaxy very, very far away, you don't see the details. And this is part of your signal, and you have to deal with it. And like I was saying, most regions are not spherical, and they are part of a very complex system. So this is like a scheme that shows the interstellar medium, where you have dense clump of molecular gas that forms stars. So there's area that forms actively stars, photonization dissociation region. You have diffuse gas, hot gas, warm, and different conditions. And so all of this comes with different temperature, different ionic state of excitation and density. So that's not an easy thing to do to study this. And on top of that, the stars, if we just focus on the star forming region, they can have different mass and therefore different effective temperature and then radiation from all the way up to more massive stars that are capable of ionizing even the helium and higher energy atoms. And you're looking at this sometimes with multiple clumps and multiple sections of star-forming regions, and then you have a telescope that is looking at a specific line of sight through that medium. So that's not easy. And now that you've seen all that, you will understand why having an instrument like CITEL is absolutely necessary when you want to study star-forming regions. So CITEL is a Fourier transform imaging spectrograph. That's the size of it when it's on the telescope, about 500 kilograms in weight. And that's the different components. I'm not going to go through all of them. Don't you worry. We're just going to come get the concept of what it is and how it works. It has a large field of view in the sky. It's about the size of the moon, a little smaller than the size of the moon. Small pixels. Oh, I should probably go back here. No. Oh. Sorry. Okay. So small pixels, and it covers a bandwidth like the visible range mostly, but we use filters with it, and I'm going to get to that. Another specific aspect of Fourier transform spectrograph is that you get a spectrum for each pixel of your detector, and there's about 4 million pixels. And we call those spexel because you have a spectrum for each pixel. So if I say spexel, it's the combination of a spectrum for one pixel. And it can scan the interference of the light to get higher spectral resolution in your spectrum, all the way up to 20,000, which is great. But in most cases, and that's the case for my survey, we limit it to 5,000 for efficiency. Inside the instrument is an interferometer, a Michelson interferometer. You might have done a lab back in the days with an interferometer like this. So it has basically a light source, the sky, a galaxy, or a laser. And it goes in and hit a beam splitter that splits the light in two equal components. One is in transmission, one in reflection. And then there's a fixed mirror on one hand, so mirror reflects back the light. On this hand, you have a moving mirror that can be displaced. And the light goes back into the beam splitter. It interferes depending on the difference of path in between the two arms of the instrument. So that's the zero path difference when the two mirrors are at the same distance. But as you move it, you start to create a phase in between the two beams, and then you start to measure destructive interference here. And you continue scanning by moving the mirror at different step and location, and you build here for every image or every data point that you gather, an interferogram that contains information about the interference of the light. So that's how it works. That's what it would look like if you were doing that lab on a wall back in the days. And on the sky, of course, you have emission from many more wavelengths, so it's not just like a laser. So typically, you'd have an interference pattern as you move the mirror. That's for an interference pattern for just one spexel. That's the position when the mirror are at the same distance. That's the effect of the air mass. As the object is moving on the sky, you have more atmosphere absorption. So that's a typical like raw data coming from the instrument. And our instrument is a tilted Michelson. A typical Michelson is not great for astronomy because half of the light goes back into the source. And we never send back photon into the sky in astronomy, believe me. We take them all. So we tilted it. So it's not 90 degrees. It's 15 degrees tilted. And we have two detectors that detect both port of the instrument. As a result, we don't observe the bullseye, but we observe slightly aside from it. And it looks like this. And I'm going to show you two videos that shows detector one, detector two. This is when we move a mirror close to the zero path difference, we would see the light going back and forth from one detector to the other. Fringes are really large, so we don't see them when you're close to the ZPD. But when you're far away and you move that mirror very far away, you start to see more, many more fringes, and that's what it looks like. And believe me, if there's a bright fringe here, there's a dark fringe on the other side. And the combined information of the two is 100% of the photons, and also it's the signal, the raw signal that we use, and then that we Fourier transform to get spectra. And just to convince you, here's a video that shows an interferogram being built as we move the mirror, taking more images for one spec cell. So you see these interference patterns. This is the result, the Fourier transform of that signal. As we have more steps, we gain more resolution, and we start to see many emission lines in the spectra and dissociate them. So that's how it works. And we get 4 million of those for each data cube. We call them data cube because it's a series of images that together form those spectra. And that's a video of a reduced data. That's a galaxy. And we're basically seeing the wavelengths. We're moving in wavelengths in the video. This is the H-alpha line, nitrogen. And we're going to see sulfur, H-alpha again. If we zoom in, we can see different area of the galaxy. And all those bright spots, mostly all of them, are star-forming regions. And we can look at spectra, you know, all over the... Do you have a question? Yes?
Yes, I was just trying to... Did you have, like, 4 million tiny little bits in the bars? Or can you push the whole image through one?
You mean, like, we could, like, stack everything and, like, when I did that image... Yeah. I stacked everything and associated colors with the different channels to generate an image.
Does each spec cell have its own little interferometer?
Well, no, yeah, it's just one big one. And then the whole image go in, and then you have these, like, fringes. Yeah. And actually, each of them have, like, a slightly different position in the interference pattern, but we calibrate all of that. We have calibration scheme. I could discuss more in detail later, but yeah. And so you can take the spectra anywhere, you know, and look at different objects. You have like stars, metal-rich star-forming region, probably a Wilfred star there, the balls of the galaxy here, in the top. And so diffuse ionized gas, there's so many things. And it's so valuable to have this kind of information because you can see the complexity of what you're looking at and identify what it is. During the first year I was at CFHT, I developed a large program for the instrument that was accepted in 2018. We gathered data with CITEL along with collaborators. Those are the other four co-PIs of the survey, so you might recognize those two. Laurent Drissen was the PI of the instrument, Carmen Robert, my supervisor, René-Pierre Martin in Hawaii, Philippe Amran in France. And we wanted to study local star-forming regions to have as much spatial information as possible and do it with the experts on the field. So we built a team of about 70 researchers. And we did a workshop before COVID. And this survey is basically aiming at studying all of the star-forming regions that are available in the local universe, or most of them, to understand their differences and especially what's the impact of where they are formed on their characteristics. You have some that are in the bulge of galaxies, some that are in the outskirts in isolated area, some that are extremely massive or extremely small. And we want to gather information so to know why it is so. Why are they born like this? What is the star formation efficiency in those area? And correlate that with a broader picture in galaxies, galaxy environment. So the sample is volume limited up to a distance of 10 megaparsecs so that we see well the region. It will be, to my knowledge, the most homogeneous database of H2 region or star-forming regions ever built at a high spectral and spatial resolution. The topics we study is star formation process at the scale of the H2 regions, at the scale of the star-forming regions. These are a few examples. The feedback processes also. The return of the material into the galaxy and how it impacts the energy and the pressure and how also it can either trigger more star formation or prevent it. We also have information about the dynamics, the motion of the gas, the turbulence of the gas. And mostly, what is the influence of the local environment on this process? So why do we do this in the local universe? It is because we gather information about the regions. And when you're at these scales, you can know a lot about the region. You can know precisely the cluster mass, the gas abundances. You can have a very good assumption about the medium around it. Whereas other studies that are studying galaxy in a cosmological scheme don't have these information, especially at larger distances. And we want to be able to provide for those studies that look at galaxy much farther away in the early age of the universe, where star formation is extremely active and very important for the evolution of the universe. Well, they don't necessarily have the information about the environment, so we want to provide them with that information and give them empirical relationship between what they observe and the conditions. How spatial resolution is so important, I just want to emphasize it. This is a couple of regions identified in our galaxy. If you don't have the spatial resolution, these are data from CITEL, and this is data from PPAC. This is about 3 times worse in resolution, and that's the amount of details that you suddenly lose just because your images are less well resolved. And that's a mean spatial resolution of about 100 parsec. Instead of identifying clumps of star-forming regions like this, you would identify just a fraction of them, and they would be kind of bundled together. So when you're trying to simulate that, it's a huge uncertainty on your results. So you really need to be able to distinguish them.
Yes, what are you searching
for? I'm not studying polarization specifically with that because I don't have the information. I kind of want to say interesting thing in polarization is mostly in the diffuse gas. Just because the diffuse gas is in a steady state, and I've been told that its dynamic is tightly correlated with the magnetic field presence in the galaxy. And so, for instance, you could use potentially the information, spatial information on the diffuse gas, and correlate that with large-scale magnetic field in galaxies. For star-forming regions at this scale, it would vary a lot from a galaxy that is super close to super far away of what you could resolve, because it's complex around massive stars. But that's a good question. I'm not sure. So we have 3 filters for our survey, 3 bands of the CITEL instrument. We gather those information here about different ions in the gas. We have here the spectrum of the sky that is very easily subtracted because we have so many Spaxel. This is another example of a data cube just to show you the data. Going through different emission line. It is really an amazing data set to study this phenomenon. And then that's half of the survey around H alpha. This is actually a mosaic of a very close by galaxy, M33. So these fields go together. And we have about twice this amount. And this is just the red filter, a very short part of the red filter. And within that, we build a catalog of 50,000 star-forming regions of different masses, different metallicity, different environment, local environments, either like stars density or gas density, and all of that to build a tool for people to study statistically star formation, really high-resolved data. And for all of them, we identify the regions and then we have these little surface area for each of them, which contain many, many Spaxel. And then we can study the radial distribution of the flux. We can have profiles of the region. We can do also in 2D. This is just a spherical, but we also have like minor axis, major axis. And we can study the component of the gas that comes from the diffuse gas versus the star-forming region. And we can extract parameter, and including also a morphological parameter if the region are asymmetric, spherical, more filamentary or diffuse. And along with that, we have thousands of sources for each galaxy, very high rate of good detections. Some are false detections. It's part of every survey. And we also have limits in size of the region. And we also estimate the size, the physical size of the region, including the aspect of image quality that is going down as you go farther away in distances. So some galaxies have much better precision on the size of the region than others. And I don't have the timing. I hope I have enough time. Does anybody have a... Oh, it's right there. Perfect. Okay. So I can go in detail with the results. So I'm going to show you basically for one galaxy of about 4,000 region here, some result that could be extracted. So it's just to highlight the potential of such a survey, because there are many, many things that can be done. Here are the luminosity function of the region. So number as a function of luminosity. This is related to the initial mass function of the stars, how many massive stars are there. I have to mention, though, that one element that complexified this analysis is you have a large sample of all the star forming regions that you can observe. You have some bias because some regions are more extinct by dust than others. Some have different geometry that allows you to see more or less of the signal to correct for that dust presence. So there's a huge uncertainty there. There's also the fact that you are looking at regions that are at different age in their evolution. Some are younger, some are older, even though it's a span of a few million years. There's a lot of things that happen to those stars, including the presence of stellar wind, some supernovae starting to explode in large regions where there are many, many massive stars. And these are kind of embedded in the measurements, but you have thousands of them. So they are kind of averaged out because you have all of the different ages, all of the different kind of morphology. And so you can draw, it's not like you have like stochastic measurements of these phenomena by only studying one region at a time. Okay, so here are the luminosity function observed and corrected by dust. You see it doesn't change much the slope of the luminosity function, but yet it is very important to do that correction. You can also split the sample in different groups. So I was talking a bit about the diffuse gas earlier, those diffuse filaments. So a lot of people study those for polarization and measurement of magnetic field, but also because we don't know why in some galaxy the diffuse gas is extremely bright and in other less. And we don't know what is the source of ionization all of the time for that diffuse gas. Most of the papers in the literature would say that the energy comes from the photons that come from star-forming region, ionizing photons that just travel extremely large distances and are able to reach the diffuse gas and ionize it where it is. Some other people say it is from AGB, a population of older AGB stars that are probably a giga year old, that produce enough, a little bit of ionizing photons, enough to produce this gas. So here actually I'm showing the luminosity function of two sets. One region that has basically a lot of diffuse gas around it, because we can measure that level, and another set that shows regions that have less diffuse ionized gas around them. So you might think that those regions are losing less photon to the diffuse gas benefit. If they lose less photon, they're probably better embedded and are actually surrounded by neutral gas that kind of shield the photon from leaving. So morphologically, it is a way to kind of distinguish two sets of different environments. And then the first one right there is just galactocentric radius. In the center of a galaxy, usually there's more metals, more heavier abundance. So these two slightly different luminosity functions represent slightly different sets of abundances for higher metallicity and lower metallicity. It's out of the same galaxy. So if I would pick part of the catalog that comes from galaxies that are at much, much lower metallicity, smaller galaxies that are irregular and really metal poor, it would be probably even more striking. But it's just to show the ability of the catalog to look into this. And so here I'm going to zoom in into the image of the Galaxy M33, where we can see a lot of star forming region. This is a spiral arm here. There's a couple of supernovae here and there, supernovae explosions. But what I want to focus on is this area here where we see star forming regions that have strikingly different colors. The colors are actually associated here with emission lines from the ions, the oxygen and nitrogen and hydrogen and all this. And you can see that they are really close by. At this distance for this galaxy, I have a resolution of subparsecs. So they're probably 20 or 30 parsec distance from each other here. And yet, even though they probably have the same abundance, because they are made out of the same gas, or around the same area of the galaxy, where the gas is about the same abundance, you see these huge differences in ionization structures. And most strikingly, you see those bubbles that have the pink around them, very distinguished change in color, whereas others here don't really have it. And so I want to introduce this concept of basically the density-bound and ions-bound region. I was just talking about those photons escaping and ionizing the surrounding gas. And what's happening basically with those regions where you don't see the ionizing front, this kind of layer between the neutral gas and the ionized bubble, like right here, these are perfect case of Strömgren sphere that are just like this. You probably have a lot of neutral gas around, doesn't emit any light, but it's there, it's blocking all of the photons, and then the front of ionization just go through the material, ionize up to a certain level because before it's completely depleted from its ionizing photon. Whereas these regions here that don't show this ionizing front between the neutral gas and the ionized gas are more like this, where they had a star, probably a massive star, so massive that it ionized all of the neutral material available, and it reached a point where it's in this like low density medium and the photons can escape and travel large distances, and ionize a lot farther as well. And you kind of see it. Don't you agree that there's a little bit more diffuse gas around those regions than it is the case here? So that's something that we can do for the first time with this kind of sample and study this. So one of the first thing that I tried to extract to show this is just to show the size of the regions as a function of their luminosity. If they are ionized bound region, their size will be perfectly determined by the Strömgren model. If it's not the case, their size will be smaller than it is supposed to be because some photons are just escaping. And so what you see is the size of the cloud of gas basically that was there and that is in equilibrium with the ionizing photons. So radius, luminosity, these are different models for the Strömgren sphere depending on some parameters. And what I think is really interesting is those regions here, or this regime of really high luminosity for a very small radius. And those regions are basically losing a lot of photon. And if I would have color-coded the diffuse ionized gas, you would see also that these regions have a lot more diffuse ionized gas around them. So we have a way to empirically infer the amount of photons that escape the region. And provide this so that when people have no resolution, no idea of how many regions are in this case or that case, then they can at least use a parameter of value that is more appropriate, that represents what's happening in generally in star forming region. Yes, and I'm gonna go beyond those details. Another thing that is also very interesting, I'm going to show you here two images blinking. So this is emission from oxygen tree line and hydrogen line in this small region here. And so I want you to see the effect of having a stochastic sampling of a different massive star. Hope it's going to work. Usually it blinks. Doesn't seem to work. supposed to. No, it doesn't work. Give me a second. Ah, no. My little animation didn't work. Give me a second. I'm going to put them aside. Or it disappeared. Ah, oh, too bad. Okay, well, you'll have to believe me. So, when you look at regions like that, that are an exact same metallicity in a small, tiny little group of a galaxy like this, you see extremely different ionizing levels. Typically, it'll have region, you know, some region with a lot of oxygen, and then suddenly some that have both hydrogen and oxygen, and some other that only show hydrogen. And they have the same metallicity, the same abundances. The only difference is the stellar content. Those stars in the center, some are really massive, like O stars, really, really big. And some others are like B stars. They have enough ionizing flux, but not that much. So what happens is that they ionize the hydrogen, electron cools down very efficiently, and recombine a lot. On those other stars that are extremely massive, the electrons get more energy. There's more collision with the ions, so you have more high-energy metal collisions. So the oxygen three line is really, really efficient. And they don't cool off very efficiently, so they don't recombine as much. So for two regions, same metallicity, same kind of condition, just one O star, one B star, the spectrum is completely different. And I want to emphasize that because when you look at galaxy farther away, you don't have this information. You just see one spectrum for an N symbol, and you'll never see that it is actually something that is extremely stochastic. Some regions are much, much more massive, some are less massive. And if you're measuring these things in a stochastic way, it is hard to sample the initial mass functions of stars. But if you have a very, very large sample of thousands of them, then that's when you can start to draw conclusions. And I have about 10 minutes left, so I want to keep a couple of times to talk about instrumentation. So I'm going to quickly just go to my next plans. I just arrived in Toronto. I have an instrumentation lab there. I will be building my team and gather students. Of course, I'm specialized with imaging for Fourier transform spectrograph. And I want to bring this technology to the next step and make it even more efficient at observing the sky. So CITEL, as you've seen, was using filters of different bands because by using filters, you're able to reach a good resolution in your spectrum while sampling the mirror like in a logical way by sampling maybe 100 or 1,000 images. If you'd have a very, very, very broad band, all the visible band maybe, it would take forever to sample that and get high spectral resolution. So you can't really do it on the sky. It's just too time expensive. And I think I have a solution for that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to combine a Fourier transform spectrograph first with a detector that has the ability to distinguish mostly the energy of the photons. I'm going to go with MKID detectors. I don't know if you're familiar with those. These detectors are relatively new technology, not super new, but they've reached a point where they can have the information about the energy of the photon to a level about 50 or 60 in resolution. So I'm going to use that basically as a filter to separate the order of my spectrograph and keep the whole band possible visible to infrared from 300 nanometer to 1.5 micron. And this is going to be my filter. I'm not going to toss any photon at the entrance using a filter. I'm just going to distinguish them on the post-processing software and basically analyze them separately and then recreate a full spectra of the band, the optical band to the infrared. So by combining the two, the advantage is that you can have imaging spectroscopy and you can reach high resolution, which is something we don't have right now in astronomy. You have imaging spectrograph like CITEL that reach about 20,000. You have Fabry-Pérot instrument also that gathers the information about only one emission line at a time. You have fiber bundle instrument that are basically fibers all bundled up into one plane. with spectrographs that enable you to do also like imaging spectroscopy. You have image slicer that slice images and then send each slice to a slit spectrograph to get the imaging as well. But all of those reach usually medium resolution of about 5,000, and nothing can reach really high resolution except a spectrograph like Spirou and Espadon. Those spectrographs are only looking at one star at a time. They are not doing imaging. So by combining these two technology, I could reach high resolution. So we would access for the first time this kind of space of parameter to look into space. It is good for extended targets, even faint targets. So it could potentially tackle science cases like the cosmic web filaments, galaxy clusters that would include also very faint galaxies in large galaxy clusters that contain thousands of candidates. We could study stellar cluster, globular cluster, with thousands of stars all bundled in one tiny area. And we would have an exquisite amount of information, extremely large data, spectral data cubes like the one I showed you. How they work, so quickly, those detectors, this is some pictures from a group I visited in February, the Mason Lab in Santa Barbara, California. They have basically LC circuits. So each detector is a resonant LC circuit. And we say detector here, but for me it's like a spec cell. Because each MKID is a tiny little spec cell, and you can create arrays of them, multiple of them. So you want these little LC circuits in series to create a detector that has this ability. How this works, so each little spec cell there is an LC circuit. They are superconductors material. And so you need a cryogenic system. This is the cryostat that they use over there in Santa Barbara. And it can be also tilted, so you can have an optical bench and send the light into them like this. And the theory behind it is that this superconductor is basically the inductance component of your circuit. So you have a material, and in superconduction condition at really low temperature, every photon that hits the detector will release some Cooper pairs, generating phonons like this here. And these change the impedance of the inductor. And so you measure basically a slightly change in the resonant frequency. Suddenly, the resonant frequency shift because a photon hit the detector. And that's something you can measure continuously. You have a system, an electronic system that basically push those frequency into your array. Whenever suddenly the resonance, you measure the resonance frequency constantly, and then whenever there's a photon hitting the detector, it shifts. You measure it, goes back to normal. Then you want to create an array of this. So you create tiny little resonance circuit with slightly different resonance frequency. So you have a series of them. Each spec cell has its own frequency. And so you can populate your band by just having these little spec cell with those little different resistance in that case. That's how it looks like on a microscope, under a microscope. They are manufactured at the nano scale level. The size of each spec cell is about 150 micron. They reach a theoretical resolution of about 100 to 200, but right now they're limited at about 35. And we have good hope that they will reach about 60 in the near future, which is basically what I need to combine it with my instrument and make something great. And then finally, I'm just going to say that one other beauty about these detectors is that they produce a list of photons instead of images. So they are continuously reading photons. And so you have basically the photon's position on the detector, its energy, and its time of arrival. They have extremely precise time of arrival over the level of milliseconds. And some projects are actually mostly using the time precision of those detectors. In my case, I just want to use the spectral resolution to dissociate the orders and have the full band. They produce terabytes of data for every night. And so you don't necessarily have a shutter that opens or closes. You just read the photons. And then later on into the processing, you have timestamps for your exposures that says these photons are part of this exposure, and so on. So slightly different than CCDs or CMOS. And since they're so big, those SPAC cells, they don't need fast optics in the designs. And if you want to increase their quantum efficiency, you need microlens array to focus the photons so that they fall actually on the material. But using these, you can get extremely good filling factor, about 99%. So that's the future for me. I'm just going to say basically that I like to do projects that start from the beginning, build an instrument that gets you that gives you new capabilities, design a project that uses those strengths as much as possible, and help people deal with the complex data that they are by producing catalogs and tools that are easier for everybody to then do great science. So I'm probably going to do the same with this next instrument, and I'm happy to take your questions. Yes.
It's okay. I just have a super basic review of Sintel. So if you have a collimated view coming in?
Yeah, it's collimated.
And then basically a green ray selection from one part of the sky. Then they're all going through the interferometer in parallel. And it's coming onto a jet. But with CCD?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, right. So there's two CCD. Well, EM CCD, yeah. Yeah, so one is like, if I go back to, that's like, because there's a balanced port, we call it the balanced port and the unbalanced port for free transmission spectroscopy. I'm just going to go back.
So you were saying instead of bouncing them off back to the sky.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. So you have one that goes in transmission and transmission, whereas the other goes in reflection. And then you have one that goes reflection-transmission, and then transmission-reflection. Those are the two different ones, yeah.
Okay, and then as you move, like you move the mirror, take the exposure, move the mirror, take the
exactly, yes.
And the fringes, the images of the fringes you showed us, that's like some calibration source or something?
Yeah, it's a laser, okay. Yeah, it's a laser. And since we're tilted, each pixel sees a slightly different position of the mirror because of the tilt, and we recalibrate that. So yeah, that's how it works. The technical aspect of this instrument is to keep the mirrors parallel or perpendicular at all time. They have to be perfectly aligned. They also have to be extremely flat to conserve the wavefront. So in Sintel, it's lambda over 30, but better is, you know, the better you have the flatness of the mirror is translating directly into your efficiency. And also the efficiency of the beam splitter. It has to split the light 50-50 at all wavelength. And we know beam splitter are designed, and they have those curves, you know, of efficiency. And so each percent that you lose is equivalent of 2 overall. So a beam splitter that would be 48% on one side, 52% on one side, you lose 4%. So you have to have really precise beams that are over the whole range.
How long with your, sorry.
No worries.
How long with your individual exposures be, and then how long with you?
It's one of the aspects that makes it complicated also for astronomer to figure out how to use the instrument. So I try to make a video. I have a video on the website that like explain a little bit that. But it depends on your signal to noise ratio. So we have an exposure time calculator. Depending on what resolution you need, this resolution will give you the number of step of the mirror for a given band. That's like something you don't touch. But then you can increase the exposure time per steps. So each steps will have a little bit more, and then you'll see, depending on your source, surface brightness, how much signals you'll get in your spectrum. So it's a balance. I want to say all of the PIs that request time with Sintel tend to ask for many, many hours, so 4 hours to 6 hours. The 6 hours is the maximum we allow at the telescope. But some objects, like Milky Way, super bright object, will take only a few seconds per exposure. So some are just a few seconds, all the way up to 2 minutes. But if an exposure is extremely long, then you're kind of averaging a lot of the vibration on the mirror. So it's not optimal to ask for extremely long exposure either.
For your new instrument, it's terabytes a night. How is that going to be? Do you like store all of that, or is it going to be anything?
Yeah.
Reduce it?
I'm like at the process. I'm thinking about that because it's going to be a problem, you know. And there are some information that we have to toss right away because it's just in between exposure. It's not relevant, you know. You're scanning. Your mirror is moving. All of those photons goes to the garbage. So we need to do that, and we also need to have a system to compress the information. You know. I come from this kind of generation where we want to keep all of the information intact and keep it in a database, but at the same time, it's not really ecological to do that. And so I think that eventually we'll have to have a scheme so we compress, first of all, in images, tossing the information about the time arrival of the photons to the garbage, unfortunately, which might be important for some other studies that like to do correlation of those time and sampling and everything. But with the amount of data, it's something that I think we'll have to do. Yeah.
Isn't the cost of a hard drive per night like 1 or 2% of the cost of operating a telescope per night?
Well, yeah. So I kind of hope that. So we're in an era where like everybody is producing more data. It's just exploding, right? And so I hope that by the next couple of years there will be solution to this, like large scale solution to this. I've seen some project working on it. Some people are using Amazon and Google, I know that, and like even at the department and at the University of Toronto, you know. We have systems in Canada, you know, the Canadian Astronomical Database, but even those cannot keep up with the larger companies that are creating storage and processing capabilities. So I don't know yet which one I'll use. We'll see. Hopefully the most ecological one.
You showed some software. You showed how much spatial resolution of spell increased compared to previous detectors. And
yeah.
How you see that these star forming regions that were like averaged together.
Yeah.
If you then like increase the resolution,
even more. Yes.
Even more substructure.
Oh yes, yes, yes. And that's why like I wanted you guys to see like the complexity of this kind of problem. So that's why we want to have like a large sample to average out those systematic problems and those geometrical issues. I have other side projects that are going at higher spatial resolution even more, but then you can only target a few specific region. So it's always like a balance. You look at what's going on very close by, try to estimate the biases, and then you take something that is more representative of the whole population of star-forming region at slightly lower resolution, but you have more of them, so then it's statistically significant. And then you help people that are at like even lower resolution on those even farther away galaxy. I kind of want to say it's still like going to be limited, and the amount of information that we would need to be able to gather at like super close by, highly resolved region is so high that there's not enough star-forming region in the local volume for this. So we're kind of like limited there by the amount of star-forming region around us. And I'm at the stage where we can start to do this kind of statistical analysis with the best spatial resolution. But yeah, if there were more close by, I would use them.
Would it be better to be in the set?
Yeah, there's that. But you know, we only see a part of the Milky Way. The other part is all like dusty and yes, you know. So we are limited into that. And the Milky Way itself is one galaxy with given conditions. So if we want really lower metallicity and stuff, we need to gather information about those small irregular galaxies. Yeah.
Sorry, I have a question also about your new proposed instrument.
Yeah.
That is using MKIP.
Yeah.
Since those were the cryogenic temperatures, do you ever have a problem of having too many photons?
Yes. Yes, there is a limit. Yeah, on my proposal, there's a bunch of neutral filters that I'm ordering to tune it down. There is that. One of the when I calculated the, with my collaborators what was the limit, it was like a magnitude, for a star, it's like a magnitude 16, which is not like a super bright star. So it will really be like optimized for the limit of detection stuff. And so that's why I'm like, okay, a galaxy cluster at like higher redshift, cosmic web filaments are pretty low luminosity. We will most likely be also able to do those diffuse nebulae because they are mostly emission line without the continuum from the stars. But every continuum source that is above 16 magnitude will like saturate, or not saturate, but there will be like multiple photons that are arriving at the same time and you won't dissociate them.
So I'm curious what sense the like ultimate spectral resolution limit makes instruments.
Yeah.
Space to keep moving the mirrors farther away.
Yep.
Isn't there like a scientific distance that they're scrolling on the line, I guess, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. There's multiple limits. So if I try to list them all, I should make a slide about those. Yeah, anyway, maybe I'm teaching a class on astronomical instrumentation, so that gives me an idea there. So there's multiple ones. First of all, yes, there's the displacement of the mirror, like you have a finite amount of displacement. The actuator that moves the mirror is an expensive part also of the instrument. It has to be extremely stable and without any flexion. And usually it's about 1 centimeter or a couple of centimeter in path of displacement. So that gives you already like a limit on which actuator you pick. Then as you move farther away, and we've seen it on one of the video where I show, you know, the two detectors, when you're farther away from the ZP, you suddenly have those fringes. If you go farther and farther and farther, the fringes become closer and closer and closer, all the way up to a point where you can't distinguish them and they blend. So there's like a spatial resolution on the detector of those fringes, at which point they start to mix up and you lose the resolution. So when we are in the Fourier transform world, we call that apodization. So the signal apodize itself to no interference anymore, or modulation. So it doesn't modulate as much because you can't measure it. So there's that. I kind of want to say those are the main ones. But flatness of the mirror, efficiency of the beams, all of that is also factored into this. If you lose your wavefront, it's going to affect more the blue wavelengths, the resolution you have in the blue. So it kind of like, even though you have better resolution in the blue, if your optics are bad, it's going to flatten things. A bunch of things, basically, that will affect your resolution.
Can I create a rough idea on this? Ultimately, what you want is like the resolution of tens of thousands, you said, right?
Yes, yeah.
But if all the textbooks that I have in mind, like MUSE and ALT, JUST, they all have resolutions of like thousands.
Yes,
right?
Yes, that's
so
correct.
Why do you require tens of thousands as opposed to conventional?
Yeah, yeah. So,
I about that, because because the line itself will be broken.
There's a reason why you would do science as 5,000, and at the same time you can choose it at 5,000 because you can pick your scan strategy. The instrument is still going to be able to do 5,000 and get more photons per steps. But for each science cases that requires a little more, you'll have the option. But the thing is, you need to have a target that provides you enough photon for each step. So you'll need like more steps. The budget of photon that you're looking for needs to be substantial without saturating. and so the exposure time per position of the mirror will increase. It's just a possibility. When you're at 5,000, in my case, I'm actually a little higher than MUSE. MUSE is usually 2,000 or 3,000, I recall. Just because I'm at 5,000, I see things that they don't see. Just to give you an example, in the star-forming regions, I was talking about the contamination of the supernovae. Supernovae are really high-velocity components compared to star-forming region. And so I see two components directly in the spectra. They won't see it with news because it's over the range of about 100 kilometers per second. But then if you go a little beyond that, then in a region, you start to see all of these components. So you see supernovae separating from the ionized gas. You might see other things that we don't yet that will just be suddenly different components. And then you can separate their signals and study them separately. So even if you go just to 10,000, 20,000, there's a gain. And I kind of want to say science studies have always been limited by our capacity to do the observation, especially in astronomy. You're like working directly in a field that is like affected by that. So as soon as we get new capabilities, we'll find new things to do. So I'm hopeful that there will be plenty of science cases for that.
Great. Have you thought about applications for large constructor like cosmology? Because there they also do,
yeah,
do lots of spectroscopy with thousands of resolution, and then you're happy with that.
Yep. Yeah, which is probably okay. But one of the thing is, if we have an MKID detector at the end with so much less noise than a typical detector, we'll go deeper, right? And for cosmological filaments and other science cases like that, just having that detector instead makes it better without even talking about the broadband and these aspects, like just improving the detectors. Yeah.
Okay, that's a good one.